This is Athens Unpacked. I'm Sofka Zinoviev, and in a series of podcasts, I'm continuing my long quest to understand this fascinating city. Athens Unpacked is made for This Is Athens, the official visitor's guide to the city. In the first episode, we looked at Athens from above and then from down below. In this one, we're diving right into the middle to explore the city's buildings. Athens didn't always look like it does now, and I'm not talking about ancient times or the Byzantine era when the Parthenon was converted into a church. You only have to take the last two centuries to see the most dramatic transformations. When the Greeks began their revolution against the Ottomans in 1821, Athens was a sleepy two-goat town. Within years, it was a capital city built around dreams of the ancient world. Now, it's a great sea of concrete. This episode will explore what happened. Greece captured the imagination of northern Europeans in the early 19th century. First, because of the ancient past, and second, because Greeks were rising up after 400 years of Ottoman rule. The poet Shelley wrote, "We are all Greeks. Our laws, our literature, our religion, our arts have their root in Greece." Greece's most famous foreign supporter was Lord Byron, and I've come to look at his memorial near the Zapier and National Garden. Byron wrote, "If I am a poet, the air of Greece has made me one." And like a number of foreigners, he came to help the revolution, though he died of a fever at Messalonghi in western Greece. This was actually years before independence was achieved, but the glamorous poet, famously mad, bad, and dangerous to know, encouraged other Europeans to join the fight. The Greeks were grateful to those who helped them, and they erected this statue here of Byron. He's towered over by this huge bare-breasted woman, apparently symbolising the Greece that he helped to liberate. Though I'd say, given Byron's erotic shenanigans wherever he went, it's probably doubly appropriate. Greeks didn't forget the foreigners who supported their revolution, but nor did the foreigners forget Greece. The so-called great powers of Britain, France, and Russia rushed in. And this is a pattern that's happened over and again during the last two centuries, with the big boys from elsewhere influencing Greece's wars and politics. I took a walk up past the Grand Zapier Hall and through the National Garden, Athens's oldest park. It's noisy with colonies of bright green parakeets who allegedly escaped quarantine at the old airport in the 1980s. This park's a really charming, if slightly scruffy, area right in the centre of Athens. It's shady paths and tall palm trees which were planted many, many years ago. Originally, the National Garden was the Royal Garden, and it was commissioned by Greece's first queen, Amalia. We've just arrived at this big rock in the middle of the park, and it was apparently where Queen Amalia used to sit when she was directing her workers. And in those days, there weren't any trees around, so she could see all the way down to Piraeus and see her supplies coming in off the boats, no doubt. How did Athens get a queen? Because almost as soon as Greece was declared an independent nation-state, the great powers sent in a king. Not a Greek, but a teenager called Otto, the second son of King Louis I of Bavaria. At that point, in 1833, nobody had thought of making Athens the capital. They'd already chosen Nafplio in the Peloponnese, which was much more sophisticated. And that was where the 17-year-old king arrived with his entourage of Bavarians. The Bavarians made Athens their capital, and this was all down to their classical education. They knew about the golden age of Pericles, and they believed that if his city was resurrected, Greece could become a westernized country with a glamorous ancient past. The Bavarians left various legacies. Firstly, they introduced beer to the wine-drinking Athenians. Fix beer is still popular. It was made by a man called Johann Fuchs, and right next to Fix metro station, his old brewery has now become the National Museum of Contemporary Art. Second, there's a small area nicknamed Little Bavaria. That's because some Catholic descendants with German surnames still live in this northern suburb of Neo-Iraklio. Few, though, would disagree that the Bavarians' most significant contribution was their grand building plan. Greeks have had an on-off relationship with their monarchy, now permanently off. And King Otto and Queen Amalia were eventually sent home to Bavaria. But it was during their reign that Athens took shape as a new European city. Architects and town planners were brought in, and they adopted the neoclassical style of architecture, directly inspired from ancient Greece. This was an extraordinary project. They built the main streets of Athens in the shape of a triangle hugging the Acropolis, and you can still see this on a map of the modern city. The streets running off the main avenues were all made to look towards the Acropolis, and many still have that view. To find out more, I'm off to Panepistimiou, or University Street, in the city centre. I'm going to talk to someone about the grandest, most gloriously over-the-top example of neoclassicism.
My name is Lazaris Zaousis. I was born and raised here in Athens. I'm an architect, and I've chosen to live here.
We're here at the Academy, and it's quite a sight. All around us are tall, Ionic, and various different columns. And there are statues on the top, pediments, porticos. It's basically like being in a kind of complex of ancient temples, but built in the 19th century. Can you describe a bit, Lazari, about the significance of these buildings?
Sure. We're in the so-called trilogy. There's the building of the Academy of Athens, the University of Athens, which is centrally located and the oldest of the three buildings, and the National Library. They're three of the most beautiful buildings of the new Athens, and they're prime examples of Athenian neoclassicism.
I have what I think is probably a very superficial idea that along came all these Bavarians, and they were foisting their foreign fantasies of ancient Greece and telling modern, newly independent Greeks, this is what you've got to be, and this is your architecture. Can you tell me if I'm wrong with that?
You are. It's a completely false theory. The reason why we import architects back then is because there aren't any Greek architects here at that time. And they have a very healthy discussion, architectural discussion, about what the buildings of the new city should be. And their conclusion is that we should use a classical vocabulary of architecture to be, you know, the inspiration from the Parthenon and all the ancient Greek temples, but we should adapt the form of the buildings to the current needs of mid-19th century. And that's what they've done, and I think they've done it brilliantly.
And so would you say that Greek neoclassical architecture is different to what I might have seen growing up in London, so St. Paul's Cathedral, which also uses neoclassical ideas?
Absolutely. Neoclassicism is a blanket term. There's Nordic neoclassicism in Denmark and Sweden. There's German neoclassicism. And then there's the English neoclassicism, say, Regency style, or in the United States, federal style. Here we have our own Athenian brand, which uses Athenian materials like white marble, like terracotta tiles for the roof and so on and so forth, colors that are different. You can see it very clearly in the details that these guys actually studied Greek architectural history and came up with this.
And also at a much more modest level, you see all these little houses built by more artisan builders who are using the same sort of ideas. So I love it when you see kind of like mini caryatids or little kind of roof tile decorations along of Dionysus or Athena or whatever it is. And it's some just little cottage that's been built in the neoclassical style.
Absolutely. Neoclassicism becomes very successful, widely accepted.
One of the grand family mansions still stands in Syntagma Square, and it's now the Grand Britannia Hotel. All the great and the good have passed through, and the bad, as it was the Nazi headquarters during the war. Then it was the British headquarters. Churchill was nearly blown up there. And it's a fabulous place to go and drink a cocktail on the roof terrace and think about that early Athens city when it was a picturesque two-horse town. I asked Lazaris about this landmark.
It's our greatest witness to our history, this building, because it's been there right from the start and still there. And it's right at, you know, smack dab in the middle of the city, like Constitution Syntagma Square. Yes, if these walls could talk, they'd have a lot of stories to tell, that's for sure.
So by the end of the 19th century, we've seen this incredible development of beautiful houses, these impressive academies, library, the university, the palace. Photographs that I've seen of Athens around that time, you think, oh, look at these broad boulevards, these leafy squares, horse-drawn carriages. It just looks like a kind of perfect city. And then what happened?
That's really a very broad discussion, but let's try and sum it up. My take is that modernism is to blame, modernist architecture. I think it became prevalent particularly after World War II, and I think we lost our national architectural identity.
What happened in Athens definitely goes beyond modern architecture, and the explanations are found in a series of disasters and a deeply traumatic 20th century. There were several huge influxes of people to the capital, and they desperately needed housing. The first wave began in 1922. It's known in Greece simply as the catastrophe. After a war with Turkey, there was a gigantic exchange of Greek and Turkish populations. We'll look at this elsewhere, but it's enough to know that almost 1.5 million Greeks from outside Greece joined a country of 4 million. The second disaster was World War II and the horrors of the Nazi occupation. Here is the popular singer Sofia Vebu in a recording from the 40s. She's encouraging the Greek soldiers to fight the Italians. By the end of the war, almost a fifth of all houses were destroyed, their inhabitants homeless. Whole villages were burnt. People were hungry and exhausted, and they left the countryside for Athens or abroad. As if things weren't bad enough, the civil war then began. But to get back to architecture and housing, Athens's population doubled in the 20 years after 1951. Radical solutions were required. The writer, Patrick Lee Fermor, was involved with Greece from the 1930s till his death in 2011. He was a family friend, and I was honoured when he presented my first book, Eurydice Street, in Athens' British School of Archaeological Research. Paddy, as he was always known, wrote marvellous books about Greece, including Roumeli, which describes the capital in the 1960s.
The fever of demolition and rebuilding has the Athenians by the throat. Streets gape as though bombed, masonry crashes, the dust of a siege floats in the air, and the clatter of pneumatic drills has replaced the little owl's note as the city's leitmotif.
It's clear why Athens changed, but how did it happen so quickly? This is down to a system known in Greece as antiparuchi. It translates as part exchange. It was a simple process. A builder-developer would agree with the owner of a house or plot of land to knock down their home and replace it with an apartment block. The original owner would be given two or three apartments in exchange, one to live in and perhaps another for family members or to rent out. The builder would sell the rest, often in advance, to raise money to start building. Soon, most of neoclassical Athens was torn down. It was replaced with the modern concrete five- or six-storey polykatikia. I'm going to speak to an architectural historian who's written a book on the subject. Ioanna Theocharopoulou is a Greek who lives in New York and teaches at Cornell University.
Hello?
Hello, Ioanna. It's Sofka.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
Good.
After we'd said hello in both languages, I got straight to the point. Why do you think that antiparuchi worked so well in Athens?
Because the small builders and teams of people who arrived from the countryside didn't need to have a huge amount of cash in order to start construction. That was the main kind of innovation, in a way.
There are some people who blame antiparuchi, this part exchange system, for the unregulated concrete jungle that exploded in Athens in the middle part of the 20th century. And in some ways, it hasn't stopped. I mean, the city became really congested. But you have a much more nuanced approach to this.
What really interested me was to sort of try to understand the architecture as a kind of expression of culture, and to see the sort of relationship between identity and language and architecture as it developed. And I was thinking, you know, why? Why is there such resentment to the polykatikia? That's how I started my research.
And you've come up to say that really it was a solution to various problems. And also, if you compare it to cheaply built housing elsewhere in the world, like shanty towns, it's of a much better standard.
The polykatikia is a much higher standard than that. So the idea for me was, okay, here we have a different paradigm of a city. It's not like Paris or London or New York. And it seemed to me that most people who tried to assess Athens really had those paradigms in their minds. So what they saw was very different from a kind of city that grew organically through the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, etc., and the Baroque, and you know, the beautiful public spaces, urban spaces in Italy. We didn't have those for specific historical reasons. Yet when we were trying to assess it, we were looking at it as if we were looking at Paris or London, and we saw that that was not there. It was missing.
The title of your book is Builders, Housewives and the Construction of Modern Athens, which I just love. Tell me a bit about the role of housewives in antiparuchi and the building of new Athens and the polykatikia, the apartment block.
For me, the housewives were really important because they were very keen to have a modern life. they were not as attached to the sort of neoclassical house as the architects and the planners might have looked on it in a kind of nostalgic way. But also the other point that I wanted to bring up is that in the post-war, the state could not possibly afford to update the neoclassical houses that were mostly of a very small scale, single family or maybe two family houses. So they kind of sort of tacitly allowed this kind of explosion of small-scale development with the Antiparochie, because they couldn't take that on.
I wanted to ask you about the very interesting way that the apartment block, the Polikatikia, manages to have a social mix.
That is so beautifully shown in those films. There's one with Vegos, Panas Vegos, who is he's a doorman.
Just to interrupt here, that Vengos was a popular Greek actor and director, mostly of comedies, and Greeks still enjoy old black and white movies.
Σας παρακαλώ, είναι εύκολο να μου δώσετε τη δεσπλίδα Χαρίκλια. Μάλιστα, την κριτική.
Χαρίκλια, σε ζητώ στο τηλέφωνο.
It just shows the social stratification that the wealthier owners would live at the top floors, and the sort of the building as it went down from the ground up, and the basement would be the doorman, the siroros, the person who did all the sort of everyday cleaning and looking after the building. So it's fascinating because, of course, there were some sort of upper-class neighborhoods, such as Kolonaki, which was definitely more expensive and so on. But the majority, it seems to me, what I found in my research, of a kind of middle class.
So you'd have the rich people up in the penthouses with the terraces, you'd have the middle class and maybe the odd doctor or lawyer in the middle floors, you'd get the concierge or the doorman or maybe students down in the ground floor in the basement, or you might have offices, shops and cafes. So you'd get almost like a cross-section of society in one building.
Yes, exactly.
Antiparochie Part Exchange was the exact opposite of the Bavarian grand city plans. It was grassroots, bottom-up, avoiding anything to do with the authorities, if possible. Sometimes disastrous in terms of elegance and town planning, but it worked out, almost by accident. Athenians have mixed feelings about their architecture. The late painter Yannis Tsaroukis was born in a neoclassical house. He saw it as part of constructing a new middle class with bourgeois ideas and habits. Like some other mid-20th century intellectuals, Tsaroukis thought these buildings were based on European traditions, that they weren't at all Greek. But then when he saw them all being demolished, it was traumatic. He wrote,
"The neoclassical houses were like the dead from an epidemic, thrown in a common grave."
By the way, if you don't know Tsaroukis, he was a superb painter. His most recognisable works are portraits of young men, often soldiers or sailors, not uncommonly in their underpants, or even without. His style is indisputably Greek, even traditional at times, but also radical and daring. You can see his work at his house that's become a museum. It's in Marousi, which is now a busy urban district. It's where the stadium for the 2004 Olympic Games was built. But back in the day, it was a green, villagey suburb. And it was stuffed with wonderful, creative people. Lawrence Durrell wrote about visiting the poet Katsimbalis. And Katsimbalis was the hero of Henry Miller's book, The Colossus of Marousi, one of the great literary love letters to Greece. And they were friends with the poets Seferis and painters like Gikas, and they were all friends with Paddy Lee Firma.
Mm-hmm.
The nostalgia and tenderness felt by Tsaroukis for Athens is an emotion shared by Nikos Vatopoulos, a well-known journalist. I'm a great fan of his writing about Athens, and I went to visit him in his neighbourhood to talk about mid-20th century architecture and the dramatic changes in population.
I was a very, very constant walker ever since I was a child. And I was born and raised all around this neighborhood of Kypseli, which was very dense in, let's say, experiences, urban experiences. And I just liked walking and noticing the surroundings. And I think Athens is full of layers, historic layers. And I think it's an urban phenomenon that is not yet discovered, let's say, by people at large.
We've stopped outside an abandoned house and Nico is peering through a little hole in the gateway. He's been showing me the courtyard. I love the way you try to understand these buildings, Nico, just from the clues that are left behind.
I feel lucky when I find an opening in the gate or a smashed window, or an opening through a closed door. And I can have a look in the interiors or in the courtyard, like here. We see a long courtyard and some trees in the backyard. And I love thinking and dreaming about the inhabitants of the users of this house, of any house that we see abandoned in the urban fabric of Athens.
Nico, we've come down a little side street here in Kypseli. We're standing right underneath a bitter orange tree, which is dropping bits of the blossom on our heads as if we're in a very romantic film or something. It smells unbelievably lovely. And we've stopped to see a building that you really like.
Yes. We just stopped because I was struck by the elegance, let's say, of an entrance door of a typical apartment building. Nothing really special, but still, it's Athens. And as you said, the bitter orange trees, this shower of fragrance on our heads. But I love these old apartment buildings, not really old, but let's say from the late 40s or late 30s, all these transient styles.
Yes.
From Art Deco to modern, to 50s modernism. So I think it's so typical and characteristic of the Athenian experience. And I remember these buildings ever since they were quite younger, let's say, and more desirable. But still, I think there is a lot to know about these typical apartment buildings because they are full of, let's say, details that are related to the Art Deco Athenian style.
So what are some of the details that you'd point out if somebody's interested in the development of modernism as they're walking around Athens?
Yes, it's crucial to have in mind that Athens grew very rapidly in the 30s in the first place because of the influx of population from Asia Minor, the population exchange between Greece and Turkey. And also because Athens was booming as a metropolis of the Eastern Mediterranean. A lot of Greeks, expatriates, were buying land and houses in Athens. So we have a city growing rapidly right before the war. So we have the expansion and acceptance of Art Deco, Bauhaus modernism, in the same way that in Tel Aviv also there was great, let's say, tradition now of Bauhaus architecture. I would say that Athens and Tel Aviv are the capitals of Bauhaus architecture in the Mediterranean.
That's so interesting. There are some people who, when they talk about architecture in Athens, they say neoclassical buildings, good, modernism, bad. How would you respond to that?
I like to accept shades and different perceptions of this very complex phenomenon as, let's say, the rebuilding of Athens in the 20th century. Of course, neoclassicism is a very, very crucial chapter in order to understand the creation of modern Athens, but modernism as well. And when we look at the apartment buildings of Athens, starting from the 20s till now, we see very different styles and very different chapters of the growth of Athens as a capital city. I think that people visiting Athens and will have a lot to know about how widespread was modernism in this city. And as we know that mid-century modernism style is so popular nowadays internationally, one will find great examples of that 1950s style in many, many buildings in Athens, in details, but also in shape and style in general. I think that Athens encompasses the whole of the 20th century in an exciting way, from the 1900s to the 20s, 30s, 50s, 60s, 70s. I think it's a capital of the 20th century.
In this second episode, we've explored the fabric of the city, why it looks like it does. In the next episode, we'll be unpacking how Athens is like a series of villages, and how most Athenians, whether Greeks or foreigners, have roots somewhere else. I am Sofka Zinoviev, and you just listened to Athens Unpacked for This Is Athens, the official visitor's guide to the city of Athens, online at thisisathens.org. You can find all episodes of Athens Unpacked on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or any of your favourite podcast apps. Thanks to Joshua Barley and Michalis Kamakas for reading the words of Lee Firma and Zaroukis. Athens Unpacked is a production of pod.gr. Thanks to Katerina Bakoyani for her endless support. Producer, Michalis Kamakas. Sound engineer, Chrisa Kurenda. Director of Productions, Elena Dimitraiki. Assistant producer, Lara Papadimitriou. Original theme music by Anna Papadimitriou. This podcast is funded by Greece and the European Union. Pod.gr. Sounds good.